Hey, I am Jamie, as usual on this channel, and today I'm joined by special guest Chris. I'll let Chris introduce himself in a moment, but Chris and I are going to talk about semi-cooperative games today, and we'll talk about that more in a second. But Chris, first, why don't you say who you are and what your connection is to Stonemaier Games?
Hi, so my name's Chris Ingold. I have been playtesting many of the solo modes of Stonemaier Games since Tapestry. So I don't know when that actually is now. Is that 2018, 2019, when the sort of testing process kicked in? I've sort of almost learned a lot about the way that sort of game designers think, really just from looking at how that process worked, and certainly how Morten and David work with that at the Otoma Factory, and then become sort of a Stonemaier ambassador, but sort of informally, I guess now formally, but back in the UK, because I'd wait until the games came out and they were actually allowed to talk about them. And then I'd go and say, hey, try this, and get really excited about it. So it's awesome to be here. And the other thing that I was, and one anecdote that's almost worth sharing, is I moved to Australia from the UK, just at the point where the Oceania expansion of Wingspan had just landed in Australia. And I'd done a little bit of testing on that. And it was a difficult move because it was right in the middle of the pandemic, if you do the maths on the dates there. And so second day out of quarantine, I walk into a game store to get a copy of the Oceania expansion. And they looked at it and I said, what are you after? And I said, after that, I said, oh, is that the one with your name on it? And I went, actually, yes. Very small print, but yeah. And from that, I became friends with the Melbourne game scene, that conversation. So it's been a hook, and like Stonemaier Games are a big part of my heart down here in Melbourne. I don't know, Jamie, if it's all right, if you don't mind me doing a brief plug. We run Melbourne's biggest community-run gaming convention. It's going to be 10 years old this year, so we're celebrating that as well, back at the end of November, our MeepleCon convention. So at the moment, we're full-on sort of organising for that, and it's great fun. It's a fantastic scene down here.
That's awesome. Well, today we're talking about semi-cooperative games, a topic that Chris picked. I asked ambassadors if there's any topic they wished I would cover on the channel, one I've covered in the past or one that I haven't covered yet. And I haven't really covered semi-cooperative games. So Chris, why is this topic close to your heart? Why did you want to talk about your favorite semi-cooperative games today?
So semi-co-ops have always had a big place in my heart, because more than any other sort of game, they really bring out, I don't like the word theme, but they bring out the story of a game. Mm-hmm. When you play a semi-co-op game, you get a story out of it, because real life is semi-cooperative. If you look at adventure movies, if you're on, go to the cinema, read a book, whatever it is, you very rarely see a film where this gang of spies or thieves don't have like a little bit of a mole hidden in there, or there isn't somebody who isn't quite who they seem. So if you really want to tell a story in a game, you need a little bit of that. Mm-hmm. And semi-co-ops really bring that out. And I find that they get a bit of a bad press, because I get really excited about them, and then I'll look at something on the dice tower and people moan and go, oh no, it's semi-cooperative. Right. So I kind of felt I wanted to come in and defend semi-co-op games, and not just kind of say they're not that bad, but actually say how wonderful they can be, and how great that semi-cooperative edge is at delivering a real story. And that's what it's all about.
Let's we'll define what the semi-co-ops mean to us in a second, but just to give people kind of a starting point as to what we're talking about, I'm going to read through quickly the ambassador picks that showed up multiple times on a quick survey that I asked them. So they mentioned Battlestar Galactica, Betrayal at House on the Hill, Between Two Castles of Mad Kid Ludwig, Between Two Cities, Castle Panic, Clank Legacy, Dead of Winter, Fog of Love, Nemesis, Shadows Over Camelot, and Unfathomable. Now, Chris and I are going to do our honorable mentions. And Chris, leading into that, why don't you share how you define a semi-cooperative game, and then you can share your honorable mentions.
So I think for me, a semi-cooperative game is, I guess, as the title says, is when a game's got an element in which you're cooperating together to achieve something, and where you've got an element at which you're competing with each other to achieve something. Probably easier to define is what I'd leave out of being a semi-co-op game. There's one interesting one in the honorable mentions that actually made me think, oh crap, I didn't even think of that sort of semi-cooperative game. But the thing that I've left out is anything that is explicitly one versus many at the start. So something like Fury of Dracula. And the reason for that is, at that point, anything with a games master becomes semi-cooperative, and it becomes almost a little bit moot. The other one is pure social deduction games like Resistance and so on, because you've got teams that are established up front. What I think is really interesting is where you actually have some cooperation and some competition, and all the different ways you can play that. And what I've tried to do is really think about the different types of semi-co-op games and say what's brilliant in each type and pull that together. So that to me is how I define it. Jamie, is that in line with what you think?
It is, yeah. And I think you're right. By omission, it's a little easier to define. One other category I thought about and then didn't decide that I would include in semi-cooperative are games that have positive player interaction where you're competing, but every now and then you're temporarily working together. Like in Euphoria, you can often work together to build a market with other players. You cooperate very temporarily to do that. I didn't include that because it, arguably that could be a moment of semi-cooperation in a game, but as a whole, Euphoria to me is clearly a competitive game. So I didn't include positive player interaction specifically, but there's probably a little bit of gray area or overlap there.
Yeah.
I did include trader games. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say, I did wonder a little bit about Stationfall in that sense. And Stationfall is a wonderfully complex game, but it's mainly a sort of a competitive kind of free-for-all. But when you go to higher player counts, snuck in the back of the book is, if you're playing with six players, there's two winners. If you're playing with nine players, there's three winners. And actually, at that point, I think if you get really good at it, it becomes a semi-cooperative game. But I think you've got to play it probably about 10, 15 times before you're ever going to get there. So I didn't count that.
That's fair. Well, what are some of your honorable mentions, ones that didn't quite make your top five?
So I'm going to caveat this a little bit just before we get all the hates and dislikes on the video, so you know what that, with saying that I have put in my top five what I think are the best of certain types of semi-co-op games. So with that caveat, to avoid having games that look all the same on the list, Dead of Winter is an honorable mention. Nemesis is an honorable mention. Australia is an honorable mention. Mantis Falls is a very honorable mention just for being a semi-co-op game with only two players, which is an amazing achievement in and of itself. And Inside Job, which may become a top five game, but I've only played it once so far because I literally bought it last week. So that's sort of creeping up there as well.
Yes. I added two. I had two from Stonemaier Games. I have Between Two Castles of Mad King Ludwig and Between Two Cities, games that are where you are working together with the people on your left and your right to, but you are, in the end, you are competing. You're trying to make, to have the best, you'll score the lowest of your two cities or two castles, and you're trying to win individually, even though you are working, cooperating with those people on your left and your right. Bit of a gray area there between a partnership game and a semi-cooperative game, but I thought they're pretty close. Dead of Winter, Unfathomable, Battlestar Galactica, Australia, Betrayal Legacy, and that one was really close to making the list. I am enjoying it. Forgotten Waters, Fog of Love, and Spyfall are my honorable mentions. So, Chris, what is your number five favorite semi-cooperative game, and why do you love the semi-cooperative elements of it?
So, number five is the purest semi-cooperative game on this list. In fact, I'm going to make a case. I'm sure somebody will come up with another one. I'm going to make a case that this is the purest semi-cooperative game out there. It's not big and weighty. It doesn't take 4 hours to play. It is Galapagos. If you don't know Galapagos, it's meant to be a 20-minute game. In practice, it can go on for as long as players want to play it. But in Galapagos, you are cooperating in order to be able to try and build a raft to get off a desert island before the hurricane hits. You're trying to go out and get food. You're looting resources that you might need off the boat, and you're all helping each other until you realize there's not enough food to feed everybody, at which point it is a straight out free-for-all. It's not a tactical mechanical cooperative game. It's not a hidden traitor. You simply turn on each other and everyone debates who they came to boot off the island or who they're going to eat in order that you've then got less people on the island. And it becomes a negotiation game. And you think, well, is it just, oh, I don't like him, so on. But someone says, I've got a gun. I don't believe you. I don't believe you've got a gun. Actually, when I was going off into the shipwreck to go and take this stuff to rescue us, I was just collecting weapons to protect myself. But I'll tell you what, I'll shoot them if you let me off. And the whole game just descends into negotiation until you basically manage to get to the next round. Somebody gets bumped off and you go through and you go through again until you manage to build enough rafts to get the people off that survive. And it is great fun. I've seen rooms turn from quiet, sort of like everyone's sitting around there studiously working out what they're going to do, until suddenly you realize that somebody's going to be for it. And it just descends into sort of chaos, laughter, finger pointing. I think one game of this with eight people went on for like an hour and a quarter, and that wasn't a bad thing. That was a great thing because everyone was having such a whale of a time. And so this is in my top five. It's basically a party game, but because it really defines what semi-cooperative is, I think, so beautifully. And so I would replicate my number five, Galapagos.
That sounds like a lot of fun. I need to try that one. My number five is one you mentioned in your honorable mentions. Nemesis is my number five favorite game. This is a game that's kind of like Aliens or Alien the movie, where with a bunch of players wake up on a spaceship and you've forgotten where all the rooms are. You've forgotten everything about the spaceship. And as you walk around, some aliens wake up and you have to deal with them too. So you're trying to steer the spaceship generally back to Earth. You might have a different objective than that. And you're trying to quietly avoid the aliens. It is not really much of an alien fighting game because the aliens are so much more powerful than you are. You're typically avoiding the aliens. And each player has their own objectives that they have to achieve to win. So it has a little bit of the feel of Dead of Winter, where there's kind of a, together as a group, you're trying to survive. You're probably trying to steer the ship to a specific place. But individually, you have an objective that might directly conflict with that goal. And that objective is the most important thing to you to win. It's a game that can have multiple winners or multiple losers. I think it's probably possible that no one can win this game. But this, like some of my favorite other, some of the kind of the pattern on my list today are games that feel cooperative for most of the game, or feel cooperative for most of the game. Like I almost forget that I'm playing a semi-cooperative game until I remember that I am. And then it's a problem because someone has gone and they've, I start to wonder, oh, you know, I was so confident that they went back to steer the ship to the right place. I was so confident that they did the right thing. And now I don't know if that's true at all. I don't know where we're going. I have to go up and see where the ship is going. Leads to those memorable moments that you talked about that I think are so important. So that's why Nemesis is my number five. Number four.
Did I go on to my number four?
Yeah.
So my number four is what I consider the best example of games that really do feel, and I think it's extending on what you just said, Jamie, but feel cooperative right to the end, to the point that they really are cooperative, but they have a winner. So this isn't games where you think, oh my God, I'm going to be betrayed. This isn't games where you think everyone's going to turn on each other. It's games actually people enjoy playing, and those that hate semi-co-ops hate playing. But you are competing, and there is a winner. And the best example of this is the fantastic, you have Forgotten Waters. Because in Forgotten Waters, the primary game is you are playing a co-op story game where you're in a magical fantasy pirate land, adventuring through the high seas, somewhere between kind of Pirates of the Caribbean and Monkey Island in sort of silliness. And you have daft adventures, fight beasties, and attempt to survive and sort of solve the puzzle of the story. And that's all fantastic. However, along the way, you've also picked a special pirate identity on your pirate sheet. And the pirate sheet will not be visible in terms of the light here. Attempt to hold that up there. There's this little kind of like sort of star chart on your pirate. And that's not going to show up properly on the screen. But you fill out this star chart as you achieve certain things about you as a pirate. And at the end of the game, the winner of the game is not the group. Well, it is the group, but it's also the pirate that was the most piratey in doing it. And you have to basically make sure that you're following the personality of your pirate through and making choices. And sometimes you'll be in a point where you go, well, there isn't a worse choice, but I'm going to take this choice because it's just more piratey. And I think right now I can get away with it. And the person that gets away with it the most ends up the most piratey at the end. And that's fantastic because it has none of the bitterness. Actually, no one cares if they win or lose. I've never seen anyone play Forgotten Waters and sit there and be upset because they were trying to min-max it to be the most piratey pirate. Just do it for the story and for the ride of it. And so in that particular type of semi-co-op game, for me, my favorite is Forgotten Waters, and that's my number four.
And this one, like a few others on my list, I almost put Forgotten Waters on my list, but I didn't because I forgot that it had that competitive element. Like I remember it as a cooperative game, even though it isn't entirely cooperative. Mm-hmm. And that segues a little bit into my number four, Treasure Island. Treasure Island, in my memory, is a one versus many game. There's one, I believe one person is playing as maybe Long John Silver, some famous pirate, maybe Blackbeard, and they're trying to break out of jail. That's that goal, that player's goal. All the other players are trying to find the treasure that pirate has buried somewhere on the island, and they're interrogating that pirate as they play. They're trying to kind of it's a deduction game at that point. They're trying to narrow down where the treasure might be buried. And in my memory, I was like, okay, we are all working together to interrogate this pirate and find out where the treasure is. But that's not correct. We are all acting individually to find out where that treasure is, but some of that information is open information. We're writing, you're actually like writing on the board to show where the treasure might be. And so after I remember that, I was like, oh, wow, this really is a really special semi-cooperative game that I really enjoyed playing, because I had that feeling of one versus many, even though in the many, we were still competing against one another to find that treasure. So yeah, Treasure Island, have you played this one?
I've not. Now, is this the Treasure Island where you're drawing?
This is one that you're, yeah, you have dry erase markers and you're drawing on the island. You might, you're trying to narrow down exactly where this treasure is buried before the pirate breaks free of prison and goes to find that treasure himself.
I've almost taken that to the till so many times because my weakness is pirate games. Even if a game's terrible, I'll pick up a pirate game. I'll pick up a pirate game for, you know, under any circumstances. I'm waiting until the full set of Sea of Legends expansions descends on me next year, and I have no room for them but they're piratey. So I will almost certainly have to try that one out, but I've just never actually tried it. And we didn't put it in our board game library for our board game club because it was markers and we thought eventually it would get too dirty. So you know, that's definitely one I'll be trying out.
Cool. What's your number three favorite semi-cooperative game?
So my number three is, and there are different sort of versions, editions of this and so forth, and is a little bit of an old classic. It's one of those semi-co-ops that I think has informed what semi-co-ops are to people. And I've had a bit of a think because it's a bit broken and a bit clunky and it doesn't always work, but when it works, it's still phenomenal so many years after. And that is Betrayal: House on the Hill. It almost needs no introduction, but Betrayal: House on the Hill, you are all working together, looking through this map, exploring and so on, until suddenly one haunt too many picks up, you know, trip on one too many creaky floorboards, and suddenly one of you becomes some kind of a ghoul and you look it up in a book. And sometimes it's amazing. Sometimes it's ridiculous and completely broken, like when you find yourself in a mission effectively chasing Harry Potter's Horcruxes, but all slightly misnamed to make them look different. And sometimes it just doesn't work at all and is completely broken and chaotic. But it's always a great story and it's always fabulous. And I particularly like it with all the extra tiles in the expansion, which makes it go on forever, because you can end up wading around this mysterious house all over the place going, when is this thing going to break? And then suddenly it does. And it just becomes completely ridiculous because everyone's trying to work out how to game this thing over. It's almost, you don't care about the game. It's just silly, great fun. What I think makes this different to me than say something like Mansions of Madness is that nobody knows who's going to be the ghost at the beginning of the game. So if you are trying to prep and win it, everyone's kind of working together, but one of you knows that your agenda is going to flip in the other direction. And if anyone wants to know what the best psychological trick I think I've ever seen a board game play, get Betrayal Legacy and play the first mission. And I think that is all that should or can be said about that. But do that and you'll understand exactly what this game has given to gaming and how important it is. And that's why it's for me, Betrayal: House on the Hill is my number three.
So I know what you're referencing there. I'm halfway through a Betrayal Legacy campaign right now. And the only reason I didn't make this list, because I'm having a lot of fun with it, is that I think it might just be our group. But when we are playing the first half of any session before the traitor part happens, or the betrayal happens, we play completely cooperatively. And I think that's generally the idea, but I'm guessing there are some groups where every player is maybe being a little greedy at times, or maybe a little suspicious that they might be the one that splits off and they need to be more powerful after they become the betrayer, or they need to be more powerful because they need to fight the betrayer. But we don't do that. We're complete. It's either completely cooperative at that time, and then it's completely one versus many later. There isn't really a moment in the game where it feels like, where it has that feeling of semi-cooperation in my particular group. You know. But I love the game.
We're halfway through as well. And well, in fact, we're just under halfway through because we started playing it with my sister when she came to visit us from Canada at Christmas. And obviously it's a difficult game to play remotely from Australia to Canada. So we're stuck sort of like four or five in. But I know she was getting like really into it, but also getting a little bit frustrated because she was trying to think, hold on, I keep being on the losing side of this. I want to try and game it. So she started trying to hoard the stuff and collect all the stuff to make sure that she could get there. And then still it threw a complete curveball into the mix and gave her quite a difficult hand to play. But it's all about the stories. With Betrayal, it's such a fantastic system, even when it breaks, which it does. Let's be honest, if you like games that always work consistently in a neat and balanced Betrayal, isn't it?
Yeah. And one other quick thing about Betrayal that I remembered, that it a clever thing it does do for especially groups like mine, sometimes it'll give you a card and the card will say, read this privately. Like, you cannot share this with the other players. So even in our group where we're playing completely cooperatively, suddenly the game is saying you must have a secret right now. And so the game is instilling that suspicion or that curiosity, even when we're trying to fully cooperate with each other. I think that's pretty clever.
Right. On that note, now, of course, there's a game that does that fantastically well, but it's not Simico. It's pure competitive, which is My Father's Work. I don't know if you've played that.
I haven't played that
one. Yeah. The stories in My Father's Work are phenomenal and probably of a similar ilk, because it's that kind of gothic horror. And they go on forever, because stories written in those days did go on forever. They always used 200 words when 10 would do. And it kind of works for that reason. But that is fantastic for that, because in the middle of one of these things, it will suddenly say, in the middle of a worker placement game, pass the iPad over to the other player. And of course, you're all mad scientists, so it could say any sort of crazy thing that you suddenly find yourself pursuing. So it's really, really exciting in that way. But that's not a semi-co-op game, so that is definitely off topic.
Nice. I'll have to check that one out. So my number three, so your number three, Betrayal. My number three is Shadows Over Camelot. This is the first game on this list, I think, and maybe the only one on my list that has a traitor in it. This is a cooperative game with a traitor element to it. It's themed after, you know, the Camelot Knights of the Camelot, a theme that I love. It's a game that I haven't even played in a while, but I think very fondly of my plays of it. I would gladly play it again, partially because of the theme, partially because I love mini games and games, and also because of how the traitor element or the possibility of a traitor interacts with those mini games, where you might say in this game, I'm going to go to the Lady of the Lake and I'm going to go take care of that mini game right now. Who wants to come help me? Who can help me with this? And you don't really know that the person that you're inviting along is there to help or there to hurt. And that level of that's the semi-cooperative element right there. You might be cooperating, you might not. You don't really know based on that traitor. And it's even a game that when the traitor is revealed, the game still functions pretty well, in my opinion. I love Shadows Over Camelot. Have you played this one? Would you consider this one a semi-cooperative game?
I'm not. I would by reputation, but I've not played it. Weirdly enough,
I think it's one of the first traitor games.
It is. I don't know. Was it? I thought it was. I was trying to work out the dates, actually, because the moment you mentioned that, my head started trying to think Betrayal, Shadows of a Camelot. I'm not sure which one came first.
I'm not sure.
I have to hunt that one down in a bit. But no, yeah. I've heard good things about it, and the only reason it wasn't at least in probably an honourable mention, or at least I wasn't thinking about it, is I haven't played it yet. Actually, it's quite sad to admit, having proposed this list, because I know that it's a classic of the genre.
Well, now you have another one to try out.
I'll be on a mission to get that one. So that's that'll definitely be coming through. My number two is my candidate in that style of game that we've referred to a lot here, that fits Nemesis, that fits Dead of Winter. It's that sort of classic semi-cooperative game, as many people know them, where you have a bunch of hidden traitors and so forth. You may have one, you may have many, you've all got hidden objectives and so on, and you're not quite sure how it's going to go. And my favorite in that genre is what I think is the kind of seminal one, really, which is Battlestar Galactica. Battlestar Galactica is possibly one of the most accurately thematic games that I've ever played. It's not just that it represents the feel of the series, it represents the feel of a particular episode of the series. There's the one where the Cylons are reappearing every 33 minutes randomly in space, and then you get rid of them and then they disappear and you think you've managed to escape and you warp off somewhere else and bang, they're there again. And how did they get there? How did they know where you were going to go? Who's the traitor on board? And Battlestar Galactica feels like that. It's ostensibly you're placing workers, taking actions, but the whole thing is really about the conversation, about the table talk, trying to work out who's a Cylon. Then you find out that nobody's a Cylon, but then halfway through the game, somebody turns out to be a sleeper agent Cylon. and you're messing around with it. And the feel of playing this game is just phenomenal. And I love Dead of Winter. I love Nemesis. If I'd have put a straight top five, it's quite possible that at least one of those would have scraped in there. But in terms of that kind of game, for me, it is still Battlestar Galactica. Now, you mentioned Unfathomable, Jamie, and I think it's almost fair to say, because this is not an easy game to get anymore. In fact, it's almost an impossible game to get. Unfathomable is the H.P. Lovecraft Call of the Cthulhu-themed Fantasy Flight version of this that doesn't have the Battlestar Galactica license, because the license expired. And it is apparently mechanically a better game. It must be thematically not quite as accurate, because this feels so much like Battlestar Galactica, and apparently it's the same game. It's going to feel a bit like Battlestar Galactica. And I haven't played it because I don't like H.P. Lovecraft that much. Well, I've got bored of H.P. Lovecraft, too much Lovecraft in games. So I'm sticking with Battlestar Galactica, but everything I've heard says that Unfathomable is just as good, and that is readily available. So it deserves to be played a lot. I just wish it wasn't Cthulhu.
Yeah.
That's my number two.
I played both of those games. I played Unfathomable once, and I played Battlestar Galactica a few times. And I'm glad you mentioned the twist in the middle. I think that's a really neat addition to the game, that you don't just start off the game knowing if you are a traitor or not. That there's that point in the middle of the game where you find out, oh no, I've been a traitor this whole time. I didn't even realize it. That, I think, and that works so thematically for the show as well, because they're definitely characters that don't realize they are until they find out they are. Yeah. Great pick. Classic pick. I think that's one a lot of people will think of when they think of semi-cooperative games. My next pick is very much in a different direction, and that is a tiny little box, A Fake Artist Goes to New York. Have you heard of this one, Chris?
I have heard of it, and I have seen it played, and I haven't played it.
This game came out after maybe a slightly more popular game called Spyfall came out. Both have a kind of a similar vibe to them. And A Fake Artist Goes to New York, there's these little whiteboard tiles. And at the beginning of the game, there is a player who is the fake artist. Actually, no, I need to make sure I explain this correctly. Basically, a word is written down on most of these tiles, except for one. And one has a little X on it. And that you hand out these tiles randomly to all players. And then all players are going to cooperatively try to draw a picture that conveys that word. So if I write the word dolphin on it, then we are all cooperatively going to draw a dolphin. So you draw like part of a dolphin. You're sharing the same piece of paper. You're drawing part of that picture. And you're trying to draw enough to convey to the other players that you know that the word is dolphin and that you are a real artist. But not so much that you give away the picture to the person who has no idea what they're drawing. Because one of the players has that X. They have an X tile. They don't know what they're drawing. They're trying to figure it out, and they're trying not to give away, as they must draw on their turn, that they don't know what they're drawing. And you go around and you do this in two rounds, and then there's a moment like in many cooperative games or bluffing games where you point at someone who you think is the fake artist. And it devolves from there. But I love this idea. I love this balance between drawing the right amount to convey that you know, but not too much that you give it away. And even so much that at the end of the game, if the fake artist is outed, if they are revealed, they get the chance. They have a chance to say what they think the picture is. And if they get it correct, they win there too. So even then, you need to draw just enough to convey the idea of a dolphin without explaining the dolphin. And we've had so many fun moments, so many really, really funny moments, honestly, while playing this game. I highly recommend giving it a try. And we sometimes play on a bigger piece of paper. I think the small piece of paper does work well, but it's sometimes hard to see across a big table. So you can play it on a bigger piece of paper too than the one that's in this box.
That sounds fantastic. Because the other thing around that is it flips the whole traitor mechanic on its head a little bit, because rather than being the kind of like the big all-knowing kind of like sort of like evil mastermind, you're actually a little bit lost.
Exactly.
how the hell do I hack through this? That's a completely opposite power balance between those sorts of teams. And that sounds great. I've seen it played, but I didn't actually know the structure of it at all, because I've just seen some people out with it and scribbling and so on. I didn't even realize it was a semi-cooperative game. So I've just seen it from a distance on the table. So that one I will definitely be seeking out, because that sounds like my perfect game, actually. I think that sounds wonderful. So I'll be hunting that one down probably this week.
Awesome. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. So we're on to the big one now. I'm so curious. Actually, I kind of know what your pick is, but I haven't looked at it in a few days. What is your number one, Chris?
So my number one, I have to caveat this a bit. This game is, to me, one of the greatest and most thematic board games ever made. And it has thematic, you know, it conveys reality and the reality it's trying to portray in a way that many other games have always failed to do. And it embeds a load of that complexity that you get in a real life and difficult situation that is going on in the world. A lot of the betrayals, a lot of the politics, a lot of the machinations and so on. It's also, unfortunately, a game which has not necessarily aged well in terms of how it portrays colonialism, because it's another one of these games that does reflect on the colonial era, on exploration of new worlds and so on. And it actually does engage with the fact that the people doing that colonizing were not necessarily doing it very benevolently, but it tries to sidestep that a little bit by justifying it by saying you're playing to be the most peaceful colonizer and so on. So I'm going to pull this one up, but the one thing that you need to know about it is that you are playing the bad guys if you play this game. There is no way you can play this game if you're not playing the bad guys, and that is Archipelago. Archipelago, probably more than any other game I know, reflects how people actually behave. You've got characters who come in ostensibly believing they're on a mission of peaceful colonization, but in fact what they're doing is they're taking over a beautiful land, they're exploiting that beautiful land, they're betraying each other, they've all got secret objectives, and the way that you win the game is to try and achieve these secret objectives, but you've got to keep the country compliant. And to keep the country compliant, you try and make sure that you've got people in safe, easy jobs, whereas you've got the sort of the reactionary forces in the country will try and step up and basically push you out. And they can do that and you all lose. But if you manage to achieve and succeed and stop that from happening, then eventually one of you is going to win by surprise because nobody knows whose objective is which. And it's a complex game. It's a long game. And it probably says more, sometimes by accident, unfortunately, which is one of the challenges with it. It says more by accident about the actual politics of the time than many other games have tried. And in doing so, it's a masterclass in what games can do. But it is dated in that way. And it is a little bit unfortunate. And I know that's something that Christoph Bollinger, the designer, has struggled with a little bit sort of afterwards and admitted and said, I didn't actually read enough of my history when I designed it. But somehow a lot of that history has got into it. So I've kind of just said a lot of reasons why I struggle with this game. But as an example of what semi-co-op games can be, it's such a masterpiece that I had to pull it up there, and it is still my number one. So with that said, and on that kind of serious note, Archipelago is my number one semi-co-op game.
That's great. I've only played it once or twice, and it's been a long time, so I can't comment much about it. But I do remember that idea of not knowing when the game would end or what the... Is it both the end game condition and the win condition, or is it just the end game condition? Remember that uncertainty being really interesting when we were playing?
It's both to some extent. Both. You've got an end game condition, and there's part of the win condition. There are certain things which are consistent. You know, you're looking to be wealthy, and you're looking to have that kind of expanse of territory and so on. But a lot of it's the end game condition, but there are elements that you are going to score for within that as well. So it's... But the way that it builds up that, I think that idea first of kind of almost like this kind of island paradise, because Archipelago has got some of the most beautiful art on its
maps. Are beautiful.
Any game ever. Yeah. It's really evocative. And then as you start from that point of view of exploring and the difficult things, and then it becomes more about politics.
Mm-hmm.
And things start to sort of descend into that sort of politics, and you don't quite trust what anyone's doing. You don't understand what everyone else is doing. You're not quite sure when, you know, somebody's, you know, trying to get one over on you. There is trading in the game if you want to do it. There is a lot of negotiation in the game. It's just so vibrant, but it makes you think. And I think that's one of the things that if you really look for from a game that's thematic, that it actually makes you look at the story that it's telling and actually makes you think. And sometimes it makes you think, oof, a couple of times. Right? It's not a game that necessarily makes you think, ooh, that's nice and fluffy and exciting and adventure story. It actually makes you think quite hard.
Yeah.
But that's a real achievement for a game to do that.
So Archipelago, Chris's number one. My number one, I think, is a little less controversial here. This is another game where, in my memory of the game, I think of it as a cooperative game, but it isn't a cooperative game at all. And I remember this because recently the sequel to this game was on Kickstarter. And in the advertising for that Kickstarter, they were saying, oh, this time it actually is fully cooperative. And that made me remember that the original Clank Legacy was not a cooperative game. This is a competitive game with semi-cooperative elements where you were often working together to solve missions that will hopefully benefit the group in future plays of the game, because you're making decisions now for the next session that might impact the next session or many sessions after that. But you're still competing. It's very much a competitive game where there is one winner each session. And I think that is my favorite genre of semi-cooperative games. Games where you really do forget that you are competing until the moment when it matters most. And in Clank Legacy, I can say that I was enjoying the cooperative experience so much, or just the collaboration with other players, because it wasn't always competitive. There were times where I would want to do something. I had a motivation to go discover a new part of the board or to complete a specific mission, but we would often divide up the missions between the players so that multiple players weren't trying to do the same mission. So we were actively cooperating, even though the game didn't tell us we had to play that way. But the game helps create that semi-cooperative element because there, without spoiling anything, there is an antagonistic force in the game itself. There's another company that you are competing against. And if that company does better than you as a group, than the group collective players, then that's bad for the players. So not only do you have like moments of kind of divide and conquer in the game where you could compete if you want or you can cooperate, but there's also this element of this other entity that is very good at the game, even though you don't really see them doing much in the game. You're just told, hey, they did really well this game. You're competing against them the whole time. So I think the game does a good job of using that other entity, that third party, that NPC, to create the idea of cooperation in a game that some groups might play entirely competitively. And that's actually another cool thing about it, I think, that groups might play this game completely differently. There might be groups that play it super competitively, and there might be groups more like mine that played it mostly cooperatively. Have you played this one, Chris?
I've played all the Clanks. I've never played Clank Legacy because I haven't had the group to play it. And I love Clank to death. It's one of my favorite games of all time. And a good friend of mine, we do a podcast together, and we were talking about on that some of the Clank Legacy experiences that she'd had, because she's played it with a group, and they went to playing it, if I remember this right, all cooperatively, because it got a little bit kind of icky when you got to that point where everyone had been cooperating, everyone was there, and then someone goes, you know what, I think I might just shaft you and leave you in the dungeon. and that's, you know, wasn't good for group dynamics. So they actually went and said, right, okay, we're going to do this as cooperatively as we possibly can, and kind of make almost some, not so much house rules, but just some tacit agreements that they were going to play it that way. And I can imagine some other groups playing it absolutely ruthlessly, or as ruthlessly as they can, because you do with Clank. Clank is one of those games where you poodle around and then suddenly you go, hey, you bet you didn't know I was going to run out the dungeon. So I would love to play Clank Legacy. And it doesn't surprise me that the second one is fully co-op. I've heard that quite a lot, that people want to be able to play it cooperatively. I would love to get a group together to be able to play the first one. And that's one of the things I'm hoping to try and do at some point over the next year, because it just looks fantastic.
I think you'll enjoy it. I'm curious how your group ends up playing if you get the chance to play it in the terms of that semi-cooperative element. I'd even forgotten, you're right. It's like in Clank, there's that moment where you have to turn around and run back up to the surface. And in our group, I'm trying to remember how we navigated that, because I think we gave each other more of a heads up. Then a normal Clank, where I play Clank, I just, you know, at the right time, I'll bound back up. I'll surprise people. But I think when we played this, it wasn't completely cooperative at that moment, but I would give everyone a heads up and say, okay, in a few turns, I'm going to think about running back up. So this is the time to start to think about getting your artifact or getting whatever your goal is here. Really neat experience. Really need to have some cooperative experience.
Yeah, I think that was it. There was that kind of, there's an area in Clank that where you've in that safe zone, where even if you don't get out, you're kind of okay, and you've still got your goodies. And I think it was, like Jen said, that everyone was going to get back into that area before anybody completely skedaddled or made sure that. So you've always known that everyone's going to be able to at least be safe and score some points. You won't end up with zero. Because that's always the kind of slightly evil fearing that that Clank can leave you with, is that you can, quite rightly, end up scoring absolutely nothing because you took too many chances and you lost. which doesn't always work in a legacy game.
Yeah. Well, those are our top five lists and honorable mentions. And Chris, you had one other game to mention, one that you're looking forward to. Do you want to talk briefly about that one?
Yeah, so and this one, I have no idea how it's going to play, but one of the games I'm really looking forward to that's a semi-co-op is called Shasan Azadi. It's a game by an Indian publisher, and it's a sequel to a game called Shasan. And have you played Shasan, Jamie?
I played it once, yeah.
No, that's right. So Shasan is a game about politics. It's been made and very, very deeply researched about politics, and it's also a kind of an area control game where you're trying to take over and manage around sort of where, you know, how you're going to get your votes and how you're going to gerrymander your votes over into another district to try and win an election. And so it's a mixture of a party game where effectively you're getting your resources by being asked to give an answer to a question and sometimes having to go, you know what, I'm going to give the evil politician's answer that I don't agree with because I want their votes and so on. And that's how Shasan works. And it actually is trying to educate people about politics in quite an entertaining, funny way, whilst also being quite a good area control game. So Shasan Azadi, they have decided to do the same thing, but they're looking at revolutions, some real revolutions around the world, you know, like the Arab Spring, and some kind of like, I think some sort of more fictional revolutions as well. And they've built one with like a moving board and with lots of revolutionary factions, but they're saying that those revolutionary factions now cooperate with each other because they're all looking to overthrow the tyrannical government that you're trying to do. However, at the end of it, as happens in most revolutions, those factions, once they have overthrown that tyranny, will now split up and all be at each other's throats because, quite frankly, they all want to be in power. And the point of that is that you want to get that position, you know, that seat of power for yourselves. You don't want to share it with your other revolutionary cohorts. So I'm really, really excited to see how that comes out because Shasan was one of my favorite games and favorite surprise games when it came out, just because it worked so well, or it felt it worked so well. I don't know. Jamie, I assume that if you played it once, you played with the American pack or?
Probably, yeah. It's been a few years. Mm-hmm. I played it like right after it came out. And I haven't played it since. Yeah.
So that one's exciting. Is there anything that you're looking forward to, Jamie, in that space?
In the semi-cooperative space? Well, you know, I was just thinking that I could probably make an argument for The King's Dilemma to be a semi-cooperative game. It's in that gray area. I play The King's Dilemma. I love The King's Dilemma. So I'm thinking, I really look forward to The Queen's Dilemma. Again, gray area. I'm not sure if that quite counts as semi-cooperative, but there are wonderful moments of temporary alliances in that game that then quickly break apart into non-alliances at all. And I'm very much looking forward to The Queen's Dilemma next year. Yeah,
that sounds fantastic. And I've still not played The King's Dilemma, which is one of my wish list. And again, I've got a couple of close friends, but they played it. They've been through that. But it's one that I really want to have a look at. So The Queen's Dilemma is quite exciting for me as well, because that might be a chance to sort of step in and join in from the beginning.
Yeah, hopefully it'll be a good follow up to The King's Dilemma. Well, Chris, this has been a delight. I love hearing your perspective on this, and I appreciate the opportunity to do a list that I haven't ever done before. This was a lot of fun to discuss semi-cooperative games. Is there anything else that you want people to know before we sign off?
Only just, a shout out to the Australian board game community and some of the fantastic designs out there, and say, if you're in Melbourne next November, please come to the 10th anniversary and the 10th birthday of the MeepleCon Games Convention, which will be sweating blood to make the best MeepleCon ever. Down in Melbourne. And if you're not in Australia, come and visit Australia, because we are now fully open and all keen to see you. And that's open to you, Jamie, as well. Come down to us.
Thank you. Yeah, I've been to Sydney, but it's been around 20 years at this point. So I need to go back. Yeah.
I will add one little point here. When we arrived, and I said right at the beginning of this episode that I'd gone and got out the Oceania expansion, the Oceania expansion to Wingspan when we landed. One of the first things we were doing was sitting in our building, looking out the window and looking at the birds. And I had the pack of Oceania bird cards, and I was like, what is that one? So the Wingspan birds cards were our wildlife guide for the birds during our first few weeks in Australia. Unfortunately, you can't do that with Ark Nova because they got some of their pictures wrong.
Oh, no.
So Wingspan has, I don't know how many, I just know they've done a couple of the Australian ones and they've got the wrong species. So Wingspan cards are spot on. It was the best bird book that we could get until we went out and bought a big fat one. So that was fantastic as well, Jamie. So it was Stonemaier have been guiding us all the way through our move to the other side of the world, which was a delight.
That's great. I'll share that with Natalia, the artist. She'll be happy to hear that. Well, Chris, thank you so much for your time today. I'll post this video. And anyone who's watching this right now, if you have a favorite semi-cooperative game, regardless of how you define it, it's okay if you define it differently. Let us know your favorite in the comments below. Or if you have a favorite from the ones that we mentioned today, we'd love to hear about that as well. Thanks.
All right, thanks. See ya.